to another episode of Street Fight. Another different episode. I'm having another panel show. The one, okay, so last week, I'm going to explain everything before we start. Last week, my partner Brett got arrested for marijuana. He didn't get arrested, he just got pulled over. It sucked. He's going to talk about it tomorrow, and it'll be up soon. And so I did a show with Kushbaum, Matt Chrisman, and Will Miniker from Twitter. And we just did a regular old show. And now we're back with Felix Biederman, or By Your Logic, Felix.
Hey, hello. Hello, everybody. 10-4 Bravo Alpha.
So
look, we have skinnies on our six.
Are these friendlies? Are you guys friendlies?
So, are you Feb 17?
Feb 17 martyrs?
Feb 15. 10-4, I'm going to ice these motherfuckers. Alpha 0, Omaha, Delta negative.
We're lighting them up.
Roger that. You are weapons free. You are weapons free.
Can I pop in and ask a quick question? So this show's about 13 hours. The Benghazi movie by Michael... Who is it?
Bay.
Michael Bay. Right?
I didn't want to say Michael Bay because I didn't want to believe that he made the fucking movie.
No,
you know?
The auteur behind Bad Boys 1 and 2, Transformers 1, 2, 3, and 4, The Rock, and Pain and Gain.
Okay, The Rock is good, and I liked Pain and Gain the first time.
I really like Pain and
Gain.
Movies.
But, I want to ask first, because that's the message that what you guys just did there. Is that how they talk through the whole movie? Did he try to write, like, how military people talk? Or did he get, like, a transcript and just put that dialogue in the movie? Or does it sound
well,
very
the book
made
is
up?
Based. The book is based on a... Or, I'm sorry, the film is based on a book by one of the operators. The one that Jim from The Office plays. And so I'm sure that all of that... Yeah, there's a lot of mill speak in it, and I'm sure a lot of it comes directly from
I'm sure they had a lot of technical advisors on
yeah.
set.
Yeah.
Oh. See, this yeah, I didn't see the movie. I'm very lucky in that I get to live this movie with Matt, Felix, and Will, because I haven't seen it either. But I spend a lot of headspace in the area where this movie is a very relevant thing.
Yeah, anyone who's dicked around on Twitter at all over the last 2 or 3 years has spent some time in this headspace of Benghazi. But I guess just to connect it, this is good because we're sort of going to school you on this film, which not very many people have seen also. Which I
yeah,
think is
Bomb, which is hilarious.
It made about $13 million on the opening weekend, I think 50 to date. But this is interesting because like The Bastard Executioner or Sons of Anarchy, I think it's more interesting to talk about a work of entertainment that is a moral and aesthetic atrocity, but still maintains a kind of weird integrity in how, in its sort of strange convictions and vision, in a way that, like, I don't know, like the Star Wars remake just doesn't have
yeah,
integrity like
there's,
that.
There's definitely a through ideological through line to this film that you can respect if only for its consistency.
And Michael Bay is an auteur. He has a vision in all of his movies.
He is Exhibit A in the case for vulgar auteurism, no question.
I guess just I wanted to kick things off actually by reading a paragraph from an article by Christopher Hooks, who is a very good writer and journalist. You can follow him on Twitter at @CD_Hooks. But he wrote an article for Gawker about going to see the premiere of this movie at Cowboys Stadium. That was like hosted by Jerry Jones, and all the actors and the real operators were there, along with 30,000 other people to watch.
I believe also that the red carpet like interviews were conducted by Mrs. Chris Kyle, which is an extra layer of absurdity.
Oh, Mrs. Chris Kyle, as we all remember her as the wife of Chris Kyle, American
yeah.
Sniper. Yes,
right.
A movie that did quite well, but
yes, much better.
Not so much. All right, so I just want to read this opening paragraph because I think he frames the idea, the concept of Benghazi in a useful way. So, okay, I'm reading from him now. The 2012 attack on the American consulate in Benghazi means many things to many people. It is, at its most basic level, an actual human tragedy, one of an unaccountable number this country has been party to in the last 15 years. Lives were lost, and they might have been saved, and it's hard to say why or what good it did. It is also a meme, a punchline, and a political cudgel. For the people who care most about it, Benghazi is less a shorthand for a historical episode than a concept, an abstract descriptor of a feeling shared by an uncountable number of people in this country that the nation's leaders are traitors by way of incompetence, malice, or both. But on Tuesday, people lined up by the thousands to see Benghazi begin a new life as something else entirely, an entertainment product. I don't know, I think that's a good way of thinking about that. There's many layers to this Benghazi story, but I think Michael Bay's 13 Hours is maybe the definitive take on it all.
Benghazi. Say it soft, and there's music playing. Say it loud, and it's almost like praying.
I think the thing that you're bringing, I like wish it would have taken off, actually, now. I'm just kind of sorry, because you're saying that it bombed, and, like, that there's a certain good in that, too. It's like, but Dinesh D'Souza's movies bomb, too. Like, anything that's in that heads, there's about, so you said it made $16 million? Or 13?
Yeah, something like that.
It's made $50 million, like, so far. And I don't think it's in theaters anymore. I mean, I don't even know if it's made back its budget.
It was relatively low budget for a Michael Bay movie. It probably will end up making money like most Hollywood movies do, but it's not, by any standards, a quote-unquote hit.
I would have liked to have seen a part two or some toys or something. Like, I wanted to, I think that, like, when they said they bought that, or no, this isn't the SEAL Team 6 one. I'm sorry, they're releasing a SEAL Team 6 one, though, too, aren't they?
Was that movie with real operators, the Act of Valor movie?
That was a real operators movie. And then what's more insane is that later in the summer, another movie is coming out. It was funded by Kickstarter. It's a zombie apocalypse comedy, but the twist is all of the cast is real operators and SEAL guys. And the Luttrell brothers are in it.
And all the zombies are Muslim.
Well, I mean, yes, that's the subtext. That goes without saying. That's always the subtext. That's the subtext of every zombie movie.
But so are you kind of saying that like this is turning into like a thing that people are like into watching military guys?
There's going to be a few, we have a grim future coming up where like every action movie, every studio is going to have to be like, okay, what dead-eyed psychopath Medal of Honor winner can we get to be in this thing for 5 minutes and then advertise it, you know, to the heartland of violence fetishists that we're trying to appeal to?
It's going to be sad when the next Chris Kyle doesn't die because he brought a bunch of PTSD-addled veterans to shoot off fireworks or whatever asinine charity he had that caused that guy to shoot him. It's going to be sad when guys like Brendan Lee, when a pyrotechnic setup kills him.
Oh my god, yeah.
It would have been so hilarious if Chris Kyle had still been alive when they were pimping American Sniper last year, because that guy was basically a dissociative nutcase. And like him going on TV to try to sell this movie and this movie studio being like, yeah, go for it, Chris. And he's like, yeah, I'm actually the guy who killed Mike Brown. I was posted up on the I was posted up on top of the Walgreens across the street, and I saw him coming for that cop, and I neutralized the target. And they're like, oh, shit, how are we going to spin this?
Yeah, he goes on Conan, and Conan's like, so what's it like, being in Hollywood because you're this soldier? And he's like, you know, I can look in people's hearts and see what their last thoughts will be when I kill them.
It's like, I met Brad Cooper. He's a nice guy. A faggot, but a nice guy.
I've heard that about him, too.
We were robbed of that amazing train wreck, which would have been this gibbering nutcase trying to sell a Hollywood product. But I think that the reason that Benghazi failed as in the box office is because, I mean, not to give too much away, because we're going to talk about the movie as we go on, but it ends on this note of loss and mourning and failure. And that has not been the film's – that has not been true of the other early year military films that have done well, like Act of Valor and American Sniper and Lone Survivor.
Lone Survivor,
even,
yeah.
Yeah, like even American Sniper, yeah, he dies at the end, but literally it's like a Poochie thing from The Simpsons where, like, they pull his, you know, he died on the way to his home sniper planet. You know, it's after the film. The climax is him killing that non-existent Syrian sniper. And Lone Survivor is Marcus Mitrell murking all these Afghans and then escaping and then getting out of there. Like, there's a moment of triumph. Whereas Benghazi, which makes it really a truly fascist text, is the fact that it's so obsessed with failure and loss and weakness.
It's
but
true.
That's not, we're not there yet in terms of mass audience. That's not what people want to see.
Yeah, and it's interesting. In, you know, in preparing for the show, I did a little homework and culled a bunch of reviews of 13 Hours, specifically from the conservative media, and they all universally love the movie. They all sort of talked about it in the exact same way, but the one thing that they all shared was the absolute conviction that it was going to be a big hit and it was going to be a big fuck you to, like, liberal Hollywood, who spent the early 2000s making movies like In the Valley of Ella to, like, you know, to snores across the country.
I don't know how they process that, because, like, their whole whenever like a liberal movie tanks, they're like, yep, free market spoken, bitch. I don't know how they handle a movie like Benghazi not doing well. I don't know how they could process that.
I'm sure there's already, like, a conspiracy theory. There's already going to be a thing where it's like, oh, you know, the Council for Islamic Relations actually owns Lowe's movie theaters? Like, something fucking asinine.
Yeah, they just called it a bunch of bomb threats, you know, if that's what happened. The same guy who killed Scalia went around and browbeat movie theaters into like having malfunctions in the screen so that people couldn't see the movie.
You know, they're really jumping for joy right now because Michael Moore's movie's like tanking, and it's like
what is, man, this 2004?
Yeah,
I know. His movie. I know. I mean, like,
what? That's the funny thing, is they are so obsessed with the idea that, like, Michael Moore is some sort of liberal champion, you know, like the idea that he's this incredibly relevant figure on the left.
Yeah,
it's like he is about as relevant as, like, the what's up guys. You know, it's like Michael Moore is as much a artifact of the Bush administration as, like, Alberto Gonzalez. Nobody cares. What's Alberto Gonzalez doing? No one cares. The same thing with Michael Moore.
I'm looking at it on my screen. I want to read one thing from one of these reviews. This is from Sonny Bunch of the Washington Free Beacon. Sonny Bunches of Oats. For those not familiar with him, he looks like one of the Rescue Rangers and reviews films for the Washington Free Beacon. And he also said that 13 Hours is sure to appeal to audiences that turned out for American Sniper and Lone Survivor. And, you know, if I would have agreed with him when I would have. I honestly thought this movie was going to be a hit.
Yeah, but me too.
One line from him: while liberals may snigger and sneer at Bay's shot of terrorists shooting a fluttering American flag to ribbons as U.S. forces sit idly by and an American ambassador suffocates on diesel smoke, conservatives are far more likely to be enraged. And I just want to say, Sonny is absolutely correct.
Yeah, I laughed my ass off at that spot.
Yeah, me and Will had to, like, stop from laughing the entire time because in the theater that we saw it in, there was an operator in front of us. I'm not saying that I couldn't have physically defeated him, because I could have, but I didn't want us to get in trouble. I wanted us to see the movie.
Exactly. I wanted to have it wash over me, just unbiased.
But that's one of those things where, you know, he's making an unconscious admission there, because that shot, for any of you who've seen the movie and for anyone who, after this, after listening to this, go and see it, the shot of them shooting the American flag is absurd. It is just this bathos riddled piece of kitsch, and to say that people are going to be mad at it is to say that you're a fucking rube. I'm sorry. I know artistic choices, you know, artistic responses are subjective, but I'm going to make a normative claim here. If you watch these screaming turbaned jihadis slow motion machine gun the American flag while it's on the end of the pillar or on the end of the flagpole, and you're like weeping, you're a fucking rube. I want to sell you a reverse mortgage. I want to sell you gold coins. I want to sell you survival seeds.
Now, to me, I'm sniggering. The image in and of itself is pretty funny, but I'm really more sniggering at the idea that someone like Sonny Bunch actually gives a fuck about this.
Well, that's the big joke.
I can just imagine a single
all these media figures, they all consider themselves tribunes to this mass of rubes who they have no respect for or connection to. I mean, Sonny Bunch, when he's going to get hammered at brunch every, you know, Saturday with his media elite friends, who are half of them are probably, you know, liberals or whatever, he has no connection to these people. He is just saying, well, I think that the corn-stuffed fatties of the middle of the country are going to really respond well to this flag getting shut up. He has no fucking understanding.
Okay, Sonny Bunch may not personally care, but one person who I definitely know for sure emotionally does care and is rendered unstable by it is John Nolte of Breitbart.com.
The LA Breitbart people are they're some touched gentlemen. They're not stable.
Writers on cinema today, but in his review of this movie, it says it opens with five simple words: "This is a true story." What it should have read was: "This is a true story the media has covered up. God damn these people to hell." And then he says,
yeah, it's true. I mean, like, when I saw the first trailer and it said Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, I thought, what's Benghazi? I never heard of that. The media has covered this story up.
Nolte goes on and on and says, "I'm pointing and laughing at George Clooney, Robert Redford, Leonardo DiCaprio, John Cusack, blah, blah, blah." He lists every actor in Hollywood. Real Injustice, Modern Day Alamo, Heroes, Bootlicking Propagandists and Liars, blah, blah, blah. This is the stinger, though. In case I didn't mention it, 13 Hours is nothing close to political.
This film seeks to drown the liberal traitors to this nation's core values in an ocean of blood, but it is not in any way political. That's another hallmark of the sort of military fascism that the film promotes, the idea that, it transcends politics.
Well, that's the language. That's a perfect thing. That right there is perfect. They use all of that language because if you say it's a true story and all the dialogue is weird, like, that's a 10-4, good operator.
He's down, going up and trucking. Gonna shoot these hajis all day long.
All my experience with walkie-talkies is through Smokey and the Bandit. So, but yeah, they you can convince somebody that, like, I mean, I was convinced by Michael Moore to take another one. Like, in 2004, I was like, yeah, I'm kind of convinced by this. Yeah, he got me, you know? So by saying it's not political, they could get, like, a rube to trip into the movie that wouldn't have seen it before. And then people are obviously going to repeat, like, yeah, it's apolitical. It's a very apolitical movie.
Yeah, but nobody bought this line.
That's one of the reasons it didn't. Succeed it because
they had to market it so hard to the people who really, for them, it's like the lifeblood of their politics.
like the average guy who just likes action movies, he saw Benghazi and he's like, oh, that's some political bullshit. I don't want to watch that.
That's me. I watch every action movie, but when I saw that, I was like, I've never seen Lone Survivor or American Sniper either. The last one I saw was Jarhead or The Hurt Locker. That was the last big, like, I saw Zero Dark Thirty, too. So I've seen the propaganda movies.
They take a while to get to the act, and, like, the action scenes are cool. Like, any time you spend a lot of money on action scenes, they're cool. But, like, they spend a lot of time setting up their weird worldview. Like, they spend a lot of time, like, focusing on the world, the ideological divide between cuckolds and operators. Here's the movie, like, fucking Jim Halpert takes his ring off and he gets in the car and they're held up by, like, screaming guys who aren't even really speaking Arabic. They're just like, and, like, his operator friend, like, they both pull guns on them and, like, hold them so close to their face, they would, like, the hammer would probably hit them in the fucking nose.
And it's also a foreshadow because they're calling for backup the whole time and being told, you know, right off the bat that it ain't coming. You're on your own.
Right. They get out of there like just by their own wiles and alpha nature. And when they get to the base, there's like Gale from Breaking Bad is there, and he's like,
I just got done with a game of Settlers of Catan.
Oh, great. More of the men who fuck my wife.
I gotta say, the one thing that blows my mind about that is that, okay, yes, Gale is a perfect beta cuckold, right? That's a great casting. But since you've already got Jim and Roy from The Office as the operators, how did they not cast Toby in that role? It would have been perfect.
You guys, I really don't think you should go out there and rescue the ambassador right now. I don't think that would be right.
Now, Felix gets to, I think, one of the central messages of this movie that I think is probably summed up by this one line of dialogue that I think really encapsulates the whole movie, in which they get back to the CIA outpost for the first time. They meet their asshole station chief, played by David Constable, a Gale from Walter White's doomed lab assistant.
A guy who's essentially like a walking pant pleat.
And he's a total asshole and just basically tells them to just, you know, shut up and do what you're told. You work for me. And then, like, Jim sort of sees this for the first time and he's like, oh, I don't know what I think about this. And then, like, one of the other, his fellow operators just sort of slaps him on the back and goes, don't worry about him, buddy. He gets off on telling alphas what to do.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And then part of their authority,
like an unnatural and secretly decadent and immoral way.
Yeah. And this at one point when he's arguing with these guys, he says, "We have the smartest people who graduated from Yale and Harvard dealing with this problem. It's not up to you." And then later on, after, you know, Jim or somebody does some awesome operator shit, they're like, oh, I don't teach that at Harvard.
What I loved is, like, after, like, he has one of the scenes where he, like, brings Jim back to his office to yell at him, like, over, like, you know, just some, like, office bullshit. Like, I'll wear looser pants. I don't like being reminded that you have a larger penis than me.
Oh, wait, there's a scene where he's in his office and they're outside doing CrossFit, like, exactly, hammering giant tractor tires, and he's like, could you keep it down out there?
You get the cutest shot of the guys out there, like, flipping tires, like, doing bullshit CrossFit activities that would, like, really separate their spines in real life. And you get these gratuitous shots of them, they're, like, American flag tattoos while they're doing leg raises and shit.
There was some excellent beefcake.
Yeah, and he just peeks his head out the door, and he's like, ooh, I hear this enough from my wife's door when she's taking me.
No, but the message is hammered home again and again and again in this movie, that really there are two types of men. And I'm not counting the Libyans, because technically they're not human beings.
They're savages.
Yeah, yeah. The Libyans are like a species of insect in the movie.
It's like, yeah, it's like Starship Troopers, basically. They don't really have any dialogue. They're not, I mean, I'm not, like, begging for a movie to, like, you know, humanize the enemy or any weak shit like that. But they're not a factor in the movie at all.
They're just, are they just, like, outside?
They're just at the gates. They're just, like, creeping around.
They're like anything. They're like zombies in a zombie movie, or they're like orcs in a Lord of the Rings movie.
They're just an undifferentiated
brown mass.
They're just getting blown away, or just like being mad shady and
Those fucking Feb 17 motherfuckers.
They're just like sort of staring like menacingly and just sort of like talking amongst one another like shadily or whatever. But among the Americans in the movie, it's like there are the five or six operators. There's the operators. And then everyone else. And
cowards.
Everyone else is portrayed at best as like a totally ineffectual pussy. Like even Ambassador Chris Stevens, the guy who is like the real, you know, martyr of the Benghazi attack, is portrayed as a well-meaning but like
pussy.
Ultimately naive
pussy.
Yeah.
Pussy. Yeah, he has these high ideals, but like he gives this pep talk to all of the CIA employees, and one of the operators in the back falls asleep. And then Gale, the plant pant pleat, is like, "Hey, what are you doing? That's disrespectful." And he's like, "I've heard that shit before." It's like, fuck all that. We know what to do. There's the one shot in this film that is the most semiotically loaded and sort of stands in for everything. And it was in the trailer, which speaks to how important it is. It's when the operators are gearing up to go in and finally do what they need to do. The guy's got I think it was a SAW, a squad automatic rifle. It might have been an AR, an M5. I don't know. But he's gonna load it, and in order to load it, he like puts it down, and there's a chessboard, and he just puts this gun down on top of the chessboard violently and knocks the pieces everywhere as he loads it. Just like so clear. It's like these lanyard dick pussies can talk all they want about, you know, organizing the new Libyan state, but when it comes down to it, what matters is this gun and the man fucking wielding it.
This is, I want to roll back to a scene towards the beginning of the movie, because this could be my favorite, like, one of my favorite parts in the movie.
Sort your shit out, Ahmed. Breadcrumb trail of every TCOT grievance. We are alone out here. I didn't see no protest about no videotape, no flyover, shot of grounded F-16.
I don't know what this is.
What's going on here?
Never mind, continue.
Okay, the scene towards the beginning of the movie, after Jim gets into in-country and gets yelled at by their cuckold boss, he goes on this mission with, like, this woman, and, like, you're already warned, like, this woman should know better than to talk to men this way, because she's always ordering them around, being like, don't look at me, don't touch me, you filthy operator.
It's also revealed that she was born in France.
Yeah.
They're still mad at John Kerry. They go to this business meeting in town, and they're supposed to make some deal with some guy who has some connection to somebody. It's never fucking explained. No intelligence thing ever makes sense in the movie. But they take, like, the operators with them, and the two intelligence people don't want the operators to come. And later you see why, because they're just these big, burly fucks with huge beards walking around their armored car, just screaming like Frosty 10-0 Tango Alpha at each other. And it seems like it tips off the rebels. Like, they know, oh yeah, the guys with like a giant new bulletproof SUV are screaming at each other. These are obviously like American agents. It doesn't prove anything to you. You're like, oh yeah, no, these guys shouldn't have come at all. This entire mission is doomed.
Well, what's interesting to me, if we drill down into the actual, like, Benghazi arcana, the actual conspiracy here about what really happened, what really went down there, this movie really doesn't address one of the key components that I always read about Benghazi, or they do, but they do it in a way that, okay, the idea that the CIA, the secret CIA outpost in Benghazi, was essentially there to buy weapons on the black market and funnel it to the whatever moderate rebels in Syria at the time.
Well, they don't say that. That's the thing. They tiptoe around the actual scandal of Benghazi, which is that there's a very good chance that it was literally an arms funneling operation to get guns to Syria. But they never say that in the movie.
No,
they're buying these guns, and they kind of make vague arguments that, oh, we're getting them off the streets or whatever.
It's explained in the movie that they're buying, like, rocket launchers so that they won't be used on American troops.
Yeah, right, you know? It's like, maybe they were giving them to, you know, the Syrian rebels. Never in there.
I don't know if that's been confirmed in Hillary Clinton's emails or whatever, but at least to me it's a credible...
I think it's credible, and it's certainly like an actual scandal.
Yeah,
that's part of this, but it's totally ignored because that's too complicated. And, you know, it doesn't fit into the narrative he's trying to make of these betrayed warriors.
And trying to put yourself in the mind of the person who, for them, 13 hours is like a huge event, because it's like, you know, finally something has been made for them that speaks to them and something that's very important to them. And trying to understand it is always, it's just like entering a maze, because, like, you know, to me there is a huge scandal all related to this, whether it's the Syrian thing, but it's really just the entire Libyan invasion, which was a disaster.
Yeah.
But like, that's never really part of...
That's taken for granted. It's like some shit went down and America went in and fucking sorted it out. That's what we do. And then some queers fucked it up by being too gay and betrayed the operators who could have made it work. Like, that's the story.
But even if you just like watch the movie with a tiny bit of background, you like see how doomed this entire worldview is, because they have one guy in their entire organization who speaks Arabic, and it's a Libyan, and they don't know who anyone is. But it's like they sell it as like, you know, this like as, oh, it just means the entire world is against us. Not that we just bungled into this country not knowing fucking anything.
Why are they so mad at us? All we did was bomb their country for 100 days and then unleash fucking absolute anarchy on it. Why are they mad? They're just, savages.
They go into it and they say these like tough guy truisms like, I hate this country because I don't know if there are bad guys or good guys shooting at me. And it's like, yeah, because you went into a fucking place with no plan and fucked everything up, and you brought one guy who speaks the language, well, so your boss could sell guns to Al-Qaeda.
Another line right up there with he gets off on bossing around alphas is a line that's spoken towards the end of the movie by Pablo Schreiber, who plays one of the operators, Pablo Schreiber of The Wire and Orange is the New Black, blah, blah, blah. To the one sort of Libyan character, their translator.
Yeah, I was going to talk about this. It's amazing.
He sticks with them throughout the whole movie.
It's amazing.
And it's like the morning has broken, like the firefight is over, like it's all said and done, the gunplay is over, they're like still sort of like recovering or whatever, and their Libyan translator guy is just like, I'm going home. Like, I'm sorry, like, all the CIA guys are leaving, they're getting on a cargo plane and getting the fuck out of there, and he's like, just has like some rolling luggage, and he's like, I'm just going back home. And Pablo Schreiber's character looks at him as he's leaving and is just like, I'll tell you what, Ahmed, you gotta fix this shit. You gotta fix this country.
Sort your shit out, Ahmed, I believe is the line. It's like, how dare you? All we did was bomb the fuck out of your country and throw a bunch of guns on the street and unleash unholy hell and then not know what we're doing because three of us speak Arabic and you're shooting at us. What the fuck, man?
And,
get
you know,
your
was,
shit together.
I was trying to think about this, like, in terms of, like, well, like, what type of movie is like this? And what it really reminded me of was these those sort of major disaster movies of the late aughts, like The Day After Tomorrow and 2012. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like
Roland Emmerich specialties.
Yeah. These movies are very liberal, but it's like, the most of the world gets annihilated and you get to like see entire cities be wiped off the map, but like the real thrust of the movie is that we're supposed to care that some dumb middle class family gets reunited.
Yeah,
like this movie is like the teacot version of that, because it's
and the funny thing is that the model of that was sort of established by Michael Bay in Armageddon.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
If we'll remember, it's like we're worried about America, we're worried about what's going to happen to quote unquote the world. But in the course of that movie, the cities of Shanghai and Paris are completely destroyed, killing hundreds of thousands of people, and they get like maybe a minute of screen time.
Yeah, what I mean is like this is the teacot version of those kind of dumb liberal disaster movies. Is because like at the end of this movie, fewer Americans have died than, like, will probably die of car crashes by the time I finish this sentence. But it all takes back against really, like, the ongoing disaster of this entire, the whole country's, like, post-9/11 foreign policy.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, the invasion of Iraq and everything that's happened before this, but it's like, no, it's this one thing, you know?
And to get to the specifically sort of militarist or fascist undertones of the film, like four Americans died, as we all know, in Benghazi, but two of the deaths are literally not even shown on screen, and those are the deaths of the nerds. Those
not
are the
only
deaths of Vile Rat, the gamer dipshit tech support guy, and Sean Smith, and Ambassador Stevens. But the deaths of the two operators are the literal climax of the film. They get blown up by a mortar, and their deaths are dealt. They're given the just like slow motion, and emotional and heart and loss and horror. Whereas it's like, what happened to Chris Stevens? Yeah, he died.
Not only are their deaths take place off screen, at the very, very end of the movie, after they have a little epilogue that like tells you, they show the pictures of all the real people on screen and like tell you, you know, what happened to them. The final shot of the movie is like zeroing in on the stars that they like etch into the marble at Langley for people who gave their lives in service to the company. And the film says dedicated to Roan and Grizz.
Yeah.
The two operators who died. The other two guys, fuck them.
Those guys.
They don't exist. Who
worthless.
Cares?
Yeah. They're nerds. They're the bitch-ass civilian nerds who don't understand what it takes to be an operator. They don't have it to be an operator. The death of an operator is worth the death of, I don't know, like conservatively a million non-operators. A million non-American operators and at least 1,000 American non-operators.
We were talking earlier about Michael Bay's profile as an auteur, and just going back in time, I was remembering my favorite Michael Bay movie, The Rock.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And if you remember the plot of The Rock, the plot of The Rock is that like these operators are sick of being betrayed by the government,
mm-hmm.
not having their families taken care of after Black Ops missions, so they take the prison hostage and they're going to launch biological weapons. If Michael Bay like made The Rock today with the worldview of 13 Hours, like the guys, the villains of The Rock would be the heroes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're already halfway there.
Yeah.
You know, like Ed Harris in The Rock is portrayed as basically a completely virtuous figure.
Yeah.
You know, he's not responsible for any of the deaths that happen, and he's completely, his motives are pure, and he dies a martyr.
He was just engaging in brinksmanship.
All it would take would be like a 20-degree twist to make him the literal hero of the film.
You know, he realizes maybe it went too far, threatening a few million people with death, but it was just brinksmanship for him. It was a bluff.
Chris Hooks sort of talks about this in his article, and about how the rise of sort of the cult of the operator since 9/11. And I think it is very instructive the way that we've gone from sort of worshipping the troops as a mass to deciding that that's just too egalitarian. Because the troops is like every dipshit in the army, you know? Including some fucking guy who just joined so that he could get college credit and, you know, works in the mess hall at like Camp Pendleton. That's not cool. That's not elite. And so like the American instinct towards worship of elites has now infected that. And so we went in the earliest days of post 9/11 from just worshiping the troops as a mass to now worshiping what Chris calls the like 1% of the military, which is these elite special operators.
So are
Delta
these,
and shit.
Are these Navy SEALs or what are the?
Well, the funny thing is, they're all mercenaries. Technically mercenaries.
Yeah.
But they're ex guys. They're like ex SEALs and ex Rangers and ex Delta Force. But they're all technically mercenaries.
Sounds like a fucking Rambo movie. Like when you guys are describing this movie, it reminds me of like the first. Well, I guess it's not as radical as the first Rambo, but it sounds. Like the last, I guess it sounds like the second one, the one where he goes and wins Vietnam for the United States. Like it sounds super patriotic. That's what it sounds like to me. And then, but is it like Zero Dark 30 levels of action, or is it like do you get a few shootout scenes? Do you see the political process happen, or is it just take place over those 13 hours?
This basically the second half of the movie is those 13 hours.
Oh, shit. So is it boring at the beginning?
They get to it pretty quickly. Basically, the first like 30 minutes exist to set up a couple of ideas. One, everyone who isn't an operator is a pussy and doesn't know what they're doing, and they're quote unquote all alone out here. Which is part of it, and I've read so many just totally clueless liberal film reviewers who saw this movie and said, you know what, it's surprisingly unideological. It's not really making any political points. And they base that on the fact that there are no references to Obama or Hillary in the film, but the film is just riven all throughout with a breadcrumb trail of references to every grievance that Teacott and conservatives have held about Benghazi since it happened. And because these people aren't online, they don't realize it. They don't know that they're making these references.
And it doesn't have to be Hillary or Obama in the movie to
oh, make yeah, no. bad.
It has to be inefficient government.
Yeah. Like, civilians, essentially.
Forever.
Yeah, civilians. I mean, the real argument of this film, the real ideology of this film isn't vote Trump or vote Cruz. It's overthrow the decadent civilian government and have our virtuous operators rule us with an iron fist. That's well, the ideology.
There's a point in the movie where the David Constable, the station chief, finally gets sunned. Like, all the shit has gone down at the embassy. Like, that's gone to hell. And now, like, the CIA station is, like, very clear that it's going to come under attack. And, like, he's still trying to, like, assert authority. And one of the guys, played by James Badgedale, goes, "You're done giving orders. You're taking orders from me. You're in my world now." And from that moment on, the CIA station chief and all of the other sort of, like, you know, Oxford shirt wearing intelligence
pussies.
Analysts, they kind of snap into action, and like they start to behave competently and efficiently as soon as they start taking orders from the sort of grizzled military men. And I think that's the kind of, it's like saying they're like they all before them they were laboring under the illusion that they weren't in mortal danger and being protected by these rough men. But as soon as that illusion is brutally washed away and their lives are in peril, then they snap into action. And then we, as a country, if only we could do the same, we would be great again.
So can I ask, is in this movie, are the people that are trying to break into the embassy the heels, or are the U.S. government the heels?
No, the U.S. government are absolutely the heels.
Okay.
That's... Yeah, no, like I said, we get every Teacot grievance. So it starts before the attack happens when... we were talking about the scene where Jim and his buddy are in the car, and he says to him, "We're all alone out here." So that's the first Peacock grievance, the idea that they had been asked to, that the Benghazi consulate had asked for more support and hadn't gotten it from the State Department. So that's boom. That's one. Two, later on, they're in the thick of it, and this is in the middle of the shootout, which seems unrealistic to me. It seems like this was put in just so that you could once again like hit those Teacot talking points. They're sitting on top of the roof, and they're like, I called my wife, and she said that this is on the news. They're saying that it happened because of some videotape and a protest. And one of them goes, "I didn't see no protest." So, boom, Teacot grievance number two, which is the State Department and Susan Rice and all that lied about the idea that the attack was spurred by the innocence of Muslim State. And then the best of all is, because there's no actual evidence that there was any kind of support force close enough that could have gotten there before these guys died, the argument now boils down to, you could have sent an F-16 flyover to scare them away, and you didn't do that. And they throw that in there because one of the guys, he gets his arm blown off, and this French chick who hated the operators at first but now worships them because she's seen how awesome they are, is like, "What can we do?" And he goes, "You need to call and get an F-16 flyover to scare the hell out of these sons of bitches and show them about America's power." And then they show her calling them up and going, "You've got to get the F-16s into the air to scare them." And then there's a shot. There's this pointed shot of a tarmac and a bunch of F-16s sitting on it and a bunch of guys standing next to it going nowhere.
Yeah, Michael Bay is a good director. I mean, there's also some shots of Muslims kneeling during the call to prayer sort of framed by AK-47s behind them. That was another good little shot.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that was good.
The only thing that was missing, like, as far as, like, the conservative outrage picture would be if the, like, Feb-15 militia couldn't make it because they were teaching their kids Common Core.
I'm sorry, I would have sent the Marines in to save everyone, but, you know, we were having a cultural awareness day at my kid's school, and I had to bring a Baba Ganoush.
God damn it, we were going to send the 87th Sniper Battalion. They were requested back to Washington, D.C. to see Michelle Obama talk about arugula.
There was a hip-hop barbecue that I had to attend, and I didn't have time to order in the Marines.
You know, to give the film some credit and to give, you know, some credit to these grievances, I think the film does do a good job of, as Felix pointed out earlier, what a ridiculous disaster in waiting this whole situation was from the beginning. Largely, I mean, almost entirely because of bureaucratic and government incompetence. But I just can't take that argument seriously from people who, like, literally promoted and planned the Iraq War. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, we were planning... Yeah, the guys who said, we need a Marshall Plan for Iraq after we invade, and then all they did was buy a copy of the actual Marshall Plan and put it on a bookshelf. These people really are aware of the dangers of... Yeah. We fired the entire Iraqi army and gave them a Chipotle coupons, and then they got mad at us. You can't blame us for that.
Yeah, so in the end, so this movie ends on a down note, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Like it's like, so when they go home, they can be like, I think, this is what people say when these movies come out. I think every American should have to see this movie in order to vote.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, and this is why I kind of suspect it didn't do that well. Not only do a lot of people hear Benghazi and tune out because they see it as this political totem, but the film itself is structured around failure. Because they hear about the attack on the embassy, they want to go, Gale, the pant pleat, tells them they can't, Stevens and Gamer Vile Rat die of smoke inhalation. Then they spend like 20 minutes just shooting the fuck out of people from the roof of the CIA compound, which is pretty bloody and cool, but doesn't really get them anywhere. And then the two blessed, perfect, glorious operators get killed by a mortar, and then they just leave. It's all about, it's essentially, in sort of fascist cosmology, it's the stab in the back. It's the you know, unjust loss in World War I. You know, it's the thing that must be redeemed by those with martial virtue.
Well, the thing I said to Felix as soon as we got out of the theater was that it was like someone gave Tim Heidecker and Greg Turkington like $50 million to make a season of Decker.
Our values are under attack.
There are lines in the movie that sound like they are straight out of one of those episodes, like, you know, we could take out the rats with one of our Hellfire missiles, but the politicians are too worried about winning a re-election.
Oh my God! I mean,
they don't know anything about fighting the Taliban and our new enemy, ISIS.
Station Chief Gale, you have failed on every front to use the Taliban to fight terrorists at all costs. You should probably step down and kill yourself.
I wish this would have been a bigger movie, though. I kind of wish everybody went and saw it three times like Star Wars. So that
if that was the case, then we would have a military government right now. Like, this Scalia thing specifically would have definitely triggered just a mass rising, you know, and some mid-level Marine general named, like, you know, General Arthur McGutcheon shows up on TV one night and says, for the good of America and the future of our country, I have claimed control of government. And, like, 45% of America would be like, thank God. Or at the very least, oh, goodness, I don't have to watch any more presidential debates.
No, yeah. Yeah, no more Obama. I mean, they want to arrest Hillary Clinton, too, right now. So, for Benghazi.
Knock on wood.
Yeah. That would be interesting. But, man, that stinks, you know, that like, they couldn't get their military movie that makes them feel good in the end. You know, they got what they got was, it doesn't make me feel good when this movie ends, but it
no,
does.
No, you feel betrayed. You feel
superior. Kind of superior to people, though, too. Like, go see that movie. I've been telling you about this shit forever. Like, that's what it's like out there for these operators.
Yeah. Of course, yeah, and then all the guys seeing it, you know, see themselves as the operators, where, in fact, they're wearing diabetic socks. And, you know, they can't win an argument with a Golden Corral cashier about whether or not they can take the yeast rolls home with them. Or like the guy in Seattle, they get drunk and concealed carry into the theater to see the Benghazi movie and then drop their gun and kill someone. Did you guys hear about that?
No, to be fair, I don't think he killed anyone.
No, he killed her. She's dead.
Oh, really? Oh.
She died.
Yeah, well, there's such thing as collateral damage in a war.
No, you know, she died, but like if I didn't have the right to bring my gun into that showing of Benghazi, God knows how many other people would have died.
That's right.
Yeah. You don't know.
Man, those guys will not leave their gun in their car. They just refuse to leave the fucking gun in the car.
Well, yeah, because you can't stop a hip-hop ISIS guy from killing people if the gun's in your car.
That's true. That is true. I've heard that story before.
I'd rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
You know how many guns I got? I got more guns than I need, but fewer than I want.
Yeah. So the other part of the show that I wanted to do, and this is that Felix went to New Hampshire recently for the New Hampshire primaries.
We can talk about the upcoming election before it's canceled by Douglas MacArthur's grandson.
before the putrid corpse of liberty is buried. Well, by our glorious and perfect military operators.
Well, I mean, there are two outcomes. I feel like we could avoid, like, the most logical outcome is Hillary Clinton, as Ron Fournier has been claiming for a year, will be arrested, probably at the convention. The Democratic Party will select Wesley Clark.
And he can on horseback.
Yeah, he can run for election versus the guy who has taken command of the government. fucking General Todd McGunn.
No, but Phyllis, you spent last week in New Hampshire covering the primary, right?
I did. I spent Saturday from Wednesday there with Virgil Texas from Twitter and Nick Mullen, two of the other most esteemed political reporters in the country.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, it was. I spent a lot of time with Kasich.
Good, because you know what? Kasich is my guy. Like, I know, I don't want him to. Here's the thing. I want him to run for as long as he can, but I'm gunning for a Trump versus Sanders debate.
Oh, God, yes. Hide those contradictions, baby.
I think it may happen. I think we even get our wish.
Wins South Carolina, if Trump wins South Carolina,
there's no stopping.
I honestly don't see him losing. I mean, and I've resisted that until the end because it really goes against so many commonplaces of political science. But if he gets another double-digit win in South Carolina, I just don't see anyone beating him.
Ted Cruz, I mean, South Carolina is probably the dirtiest fucking primary there is, and it's sort of made for a piece of shit like Ted Cruz. Like, Ted Cruz is, like, already calling. Like, there are already Ted Cruz robocalls that are like, if you heard that Donald Trump was gender non-binary, but I don't think he's going to get it done. I just don't.
I think it's just too big of a gap at this point.
Yeah.
Like he's operating off a 20-point. He's operating off of a 20-point deficit. I don't think any amount of public appearances where he has stigmata, you know, and speaks in tongues are going to be enough to derail the Trump train.
Oh, so I saw Ted Cruz in person.
Oh, yeah.
You surprised me by saying that he actually isn't as unnerving looking in person as he is on television.
Well, I mean, he is, like, parts of him are. Like, his face is still, like, fucking awful. Like, he has those little doll eyes and just...
That nose, the drippy nose that looks like it's made of wax.
Yeah, but I feel like he's tucked in the neck. Or he, like, I don't know, maybe vacuumed it in that day. Some days you have a good day. Some days you just, like, look at yourself and you're like, oh, I'm looking good today. And maybe that was the day. But, you know, I was also harassing him, so.
You are.
You have a weird look.
Huh? Yeah. Did you meet anybody up there who was pining for the military to make all this go away?
No, the New Hampshire Republican is a different type of person. They're, like, this is, like, my theory on why. Like, everyone, every, like, dipshit, lanyard dick fucking moron that we follow on Carl Diggler's account, the worst feed on Twitter, the absolute worst, was like, Marco ruined his chances of the thing. But it's like, yeah, it fucked him up in New Hampshire. But he would have never done well there because Marco's entire campaign is just, it's like A, his bullshit storyline, and B, it's just warmed over project for a new American century bullshit. Just, you know, the same shit we've been hearing for 25 years now spoken out of his mouth. And, like, they don't really respond to that up there. It's not really their
thing. No, they want a guy who gets down in the dirt, a guy who tells them about their, you know, trials and all the hitchhiking and all the times they got fired being a dishwasher at a restaurant and all that.
Kasich is their man.
That's Kasich. That's why Kasich did so well. Kasich just goes up there with his weathered face.
I've seen things.
I don't really go to Concord. They have it out for me there. And all the people are like, they have it out for me too.
One of the things that got me was watching when you went to one of Kasich's things and you were showing the food there, and I was like, this motherfucker is, that was the most Ohio terrible.
Those tendies? Food. Those chicken tendies?
Yeah. First of all, Kasich's food was like Kasich went to Costco and like robbed them.
That's how we do it here. That's how we have potlucks here.
It was an Ohio potluck. It was a bizarre assortment. Like, you would go to this table and you would get broccoli and smother it with ranch. Then you'd get a few pieces of pineapple and crackers and cheese and then some tendies.
And then one table is just, like, a ton of, like, Entenmann's coffee cake.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So, did you get to talk to John Cat? How, like, who, I guess, like, and of the people that I know in this city, and in Ohio, none of them like John Kasich.
Right.
Nobody fucking likes him. So, like, did you rub up against people who were like, I really like this. This John Kasich really inspires me?
Oh, here's the thing. Here's, like, okay, so this is the contrast between Kasich's people and Rubio's people. Rubio's people are just, like, as fucking shitty as you'd imagine. They all have the same haircut. Like, they all dress the same. They're all, like, just chewing ice. They're so sexually frustrated. And they're just, like, just, like, barely talk, like, can barely get words out of their clenched jaw. They're angry at you because they've never heard of Cafe. Felix, who are you? Who are you? Okay, get in there. The Kasich people were all just these, like, telegenic Mormon-looking kids and, like, very nice moms. Like, it was all, like, like probably 20-year-old dudes in dry fit shirts, like, hey, yeah, what's up? I work for the campaign. You're press. Go on in there. Or like moms who would be like, oh, you're with Cafe. I love coffee. Like lame, nice people. There was a guy who looked like he like moonlights as a mannequin at Brooks Brothers who came into the press room at the Kasich victory thing and was like, Kasich rocks!
Like, the Kasich victory thing where he got 19% of the vote.
Exactly, where he lost 2-1 to Trump. More than 2-1 to Trump.
I wanted to ask you one of the things that you mentioned in your dispatches about the Kasich child soldier.
Yes, there's a Kasich kid. Okay. There was a 15-year-old kid who was in, like, a skin-type Under Armour getup that was branded as a Kasich.
It was a Kasich-branded Under Armour shirt.
Hell yeah. That's very, like, oh, my God.
It was, yeah, he had, like, a boy, and it was at one of the town halls, and he was like, oh, Governor Kasich, I'm the head of your Michigan committee. And he, like, questioning. Kasich, like, he tried to answer with a joke. I feel like Kasich's aides, they told him to memorize certain stories and anecdotes of people he met up there and, like, things he's supposed to say, but he fucks them up because he wants to tell jokes. But his jokes are always, like, weird and disconcerting because when he answers the kid's question about, like, you know, fucking whatever, he goes, yeah, I'll tell you what, I'd like to kidnap the two football coaches in Michigan and get them in the car and then I could win the state. And you're like, that's not a complete joke. You just climb that you want to do.
Yeah, that is kind of a plan, it sounds like you have. Shit, yeah, Kasich.
But the Kasich kid was like, Nick just kept going on this thing that, like, he's this boy that's passed around campaigns. My dad's the wrestling coach.
The Republicans own a kid.
Yeah.
Like, they had two top Republicans make a kid, and they were like, well, this is the... He's the Kasich kid today. Tomorrow he's going to be the... I don't know. I just blanked on Republicans for some reason.
Boy for sale. Boy for sale.
Rubio rolls up. It's like, how much for that kid?
I'm fascinated.
Can he roll his R's? Can he realistically pretend to speak Spanish?
I don't think that matters to Kasich. I don't think Kasich's ever spoken.
No, it's not for the rope if Rubio bought it.
Now, Felix, did you also say you went to a Marco Rubio pancake breakfast in which his campaign did not furnish with pancakes?
Fucking moron. Yeah, they just... Rubio couldn't stop fucking up. My theory is that, like, Chris...
He's a bungler.
Yeah, he is a bungler. Chris Christie, like, scared the shit out of him. Like, in a kamikaze blimp attack. Like, if Muhammad...
the humanity.
And I think it just ruined Rubio because... Yeah, he was supposed to have a fucking pancake breakfast. It ended up being muffins. Chris Christie, may he rest in peace, would have never made that mistake. That
man knows his fucking pastries. That's right. Breakfast foods.
And then that day, we were supposed to go to a Rubio thing, and it was like just the most unappealing set of words that have ever been offered to me. Watch the Super Bowl with Marco.
Oh my God.
Imagine this fucking quarter zip sweater. Like, you watch him a game with his hands on his lap, and he waits for an aide to whisper in his ear, and then he takes exactly one sip of Coors Light.
Of Michelob Ultra.
But yeah.
Wow, this you know, I usually watch it for the commercials, but this game is pretty exciting.
Oh, Rubio would try to, like, say something about it. Like,
now, Rubio's wife is a former Miami Dolphins cheerleader.
That's right, yeah, no, one of Rubio's harem. Rubio can't stop talking. But he fucked up, and it wasn't like when we got there, it was a weird country club. There was a sign on the door that was like, Marco Rubio's Super Bowl event is in, you know, in some other New Hampshire town that was 20 minutes away. So we drive to the address they give us, and it's this YMCA. We get there, and there's press people there, and they're like, no, he's actually at the steel worker plant or some bullshit. And we were just furious at this point because Rubio's schedule, he fucked up so bad and didn't give anyone the right directions to where he was. We got there, the parking was filled up, and these people in the lot next to us were like, next to the Marco thing, were like, oh, if you give us $10, we can park here. But we were just like, we're not going to part with any more money or time in this world because of Marco fucking Rubio.
But this is great shoe leather reporting because, I mean, he finished in fifth place or, like, something like that.
He got fucking killed.
Like, you know, again, like, it's funny to me that you do this as a joke, but there are, like, idiots who get on, you know, this week with George Snuffleupagus, every week who are like, I just hear things. I don't know. Don't be surprised if Rubio has a strong showing in New Hampshire. But they just say these things because they want to will it into reality.
Oh, no, yeah, no. They're, like, party operatives who just, like, want people to repeat them. But that shit doesn't work. And, like, we take a very unscientific approach where we, like, try to go to campaign events. And we usually don't make it because we're incompetent. But when we do, we look at things like attendees and look at how telegenic their workers may be. And we make decisions based on that. So far, we've predicted Iowa and New Hampshire with, like, 95% accuracy.
Because I honestly think that is the way to do it.
It is. It's a way better bellwether than anything else.
Like, yeah, these guys who are hyping Rubio, it's like, because, yes, you've got an RNC that is very invested in having somebody who they can spin as moderate get the nomination, so they're pumping up Rubio, and the mainstream media has an unspoken but very deep desire to have that same thing so that they can continue operating off of this fake, you know, even-handed position where they don't have to acknowledge that one of the nominees is a frothing psychopath. So they want to be able to also say, oh, you know, at the end of the day, we all move towards something that we can understand. We might disagree, but like, Rubio is a robot But the only times, if you watch the debates, that he actually seems to give a shit is when he's talking about bombing the fuck out of Iran.
Right.
It's like his eyes get glassy, and he starts talking about a new American century and, like, paving the America's path in the blood of Middle Easterners. And it's like, holy shit.
And
there's nothing moderate about this. This is terrifying.
They're all psychos at that. I mean, even Kasich, who barely talks about foreign policy, he will say things like, well, the Shia are our mortal enemies.
And yeah. They hate the Shia. And that's so amazing to me that they've made that pick. They're like, yeah, we're going all in on the Sunni awakening, which is responsible for 99.9% of American deaths to terrorism history.
Exactly. But like Rubio is the biggest psycho. He sounds like the biggest fucking lunatic with all of it. Like Ted Cruz is a crazy person with it too, but what he says is like very Bircher. Like, we're not trying hard enough to win. We need carpet bombs. We need to make the sand glow in the dark. Just, like, stupid, crazy person shit. That's
like, he's sort of Bircherite in the way that the Birchers were against the Vietnam War, not because they thought it was, like...
Yeah, we won't go far enough. Yeah.
They just thought it was, like, we should be fighting a war with Russia and China. Yeah. Why are we fighting in Vietnam?
But Rubio is, like, yeah, no, he's the same, like, Project for a New American Century... neocon bullshit guy that they've like put a new face on. Unfortunately for them, Rubio is a fucking moron. He's dumb as fuck when you hear him talk. When he has to do any thinking, you can see him think. You saw it at the debate like a few nights ago when Trump like blamed Bush for 9/11, and it was hilarious and it ruled. And Rubio went, I thank God every single day George Bush was president. It's like, do you?
Do you really do that?
God for that every day.
What a great line. Think of that, though. He's like, oh, well, I thank God he was president during the worst national security disaster in American history. Well, who else could have been president?
He was responsible in every way for the response to it, but not that it happened. It's this quantum state that he's in. It's pretty impressive.
But you can see how he thinks. Like, he's it's like when you learn a foreign language and you learn, like, the things that you need to start a sentence with. He's like, okay, I need to start the sentence with, I thank God. Parker Rubio doesn't fucking pray every day. He's switched religions how many times? Like, he used to be a fucking Mormon.
He was, yes, and he was an evangelical for a while.
He used to be a Mormon?
Yeah.
Yes. He was a Mormon, and he was an evangelical, too. Yeah.
What is he now?
Has he ever been a Unitarian? Is he a Unitarian?
He was a Zoroastrian for a bit. He was into that, you know. He had some fun with that. He dabbled in Sikhism.
Yeah, Rubio is a Sufi.
Hopefully he becomes a Pastafarian when he's president.
Oh, that would be epic.
That would be, yeah, Le Win.
He becomes he's a baconist. Epic baconist.
He strikes me as fucking stupid enough that if like there is a big scandal, like if one of the 50 rumors about him plopping out an illegitimate kid are true, like he's King Robert.
I've heard those.
And he just falls from grace and we don't hear from him for 5 years, he'll come back and be like, yeah, I realize religion is bullshit. I chive now.
He's gonna fucking take over for Gary Johnson, the libertarian.
Bob Barr. I'm so sick of like just every piece of shit being a piece of shit for 20 years and being like, well, I shook a gay person's hand and here's what I think now, and then they get to have a documentary made about them. Like, no, fuck you. You're still a piece of shit.
Yeah. Well, especially since their great like revelation is, you know, I still think that poor people should die screaming in gutters for the crime of being born poor, but gay people getting married is okay.
Yeah, I'm starting to digress on this. Like, Bob Barr, I fucking hate Bob Barr so much, but he came back in 2008 with, like, these cool guy glasses, and he's like, I don't think gay people deserve AIDS anymore. It's like, good for you. He fucking died in the 90s, you piece of shit.
I guarantee you Bob Barr vapes at this point.
Oh, God.
Did you see that Grover Norquist has been saying that vaping is going to decide this election?
Yep. And,
He says Republican
Duncan Hunter vaped on the House floor.
Yeah, he says Republican candidates need to, like, mobilize, like, the 10 million Americans who vape and just start hitting home that Hillary Clinton wants to, like, overregulate the vaping community.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, see, I would love that because Hillary, like, they're, like, her team of foot fetishists and idiots would be like, we have to respond to this, and they would make a video where she vapes.
Well, that just shows how dumb Norquist is because the vape, if there was a vape vote to be had, it was to be had by Rand Paul.
Exactly.
And that bitch is out of the race. So clearly the vapists do not have the electoral weight that they're claiming.
No.
Because Rand Paul was just suit tailor-made for the vape crowd, and they didn't give him anything.
Can we talk about Hillary Clinton for a second? Because Felix brought up her, you know, battalion of sycophants and morons who have been close to her for now 20 years, but are, like, remarkably, like the worst political operatives maybe ever. Like, she may lose this nomination again.
Which would be hilarious.
Which would be hysterical. And it's just like, who are these people who, have, like, you know, they make, like, 50 grand a day advising her on what to do. And it's just like, her lead is shrinking in South Carolina, and she may lose Nevada, too.
Well, it's because they don't – because the job of political operative is stunningly unconnected to results. Like, there used to be a joke about how, like, Bob Shrum – Shrum?
Yeah.
How he was, like, in charge of five straight losing presidential campaigns, and he just kept getting hired. I mean, because you can't – it's just – it's like – it's very similar in a lot of ways. There's a ton of similarities between – between the economics and sort of the mindset of the people who are hired to be consultants and operators within political parties and people in sports, like general managers and stuff. It's just this small club of people, and once you're in the club, you just get recycled, you know, regardless of your results. Donna Brazil, it's like how many times did freaking, you know, like Chan Gailey get a job in the NFL without being just a complete failure his whole career? It's like, yeah, but we know him. We don't want some random person from out of nowhere. And it's the same thing. They want someone they feel comfortable with way more than they want anybody who can point to actual results.
I mean, you see with Peter Dow. If you go to Peter Dow's website, first, Peter Dow, my favorite fucking Hillary person in the world for many.
He's amazing.
But Peter Dow, you see when you go to his website, after you see the thing that says war survivor. He's going to say so it's Joseph Mengele. But
he was a refugee, technically.
Yeah, that's right. Like Steve Jobs. But
Steve Jobs, Joseph Mengele. These are the people we're trying
Steve
to keep
Jobs
out of America.
Is worse, in my opinion.
after he talks about, you know, that, he says, he goes, I've worked for John Kerry, Hillary Clinton in 2008, just like listing all these things he was a part of that he failed on.
Well, just like another one is Liz Mayer. You guys know Liz Mayer?
Yeah.
I looked at her Twitter bio, and it says, this is what it says in her Twitter bio, former online comms strategist to Senator Paul, Governors Walker, Perry, and Carly Fiorina. A fucking parade of losers!
Hey,
with what, if you brought that resume into fucking Burger King, they wouldn't hire you. And I guarantee you she's going to have gigs for the rest of her life.
Easily.
Oh, my God. Did you see any Carly Fiorina stuff there, Felix?
Carly! Miss Carly Fiorina!
Fuck yeah. We went to Carly Fiorina. She was at a restaurant. By the way, they have the biggest restaurants in the world in New Hampshire, and I don't know why. It was like a
three-day restaurant
that was like...
Small state, big restaurants.
Well, it's like they have the world. They have the nation's largest state house of representatives. They have like 500 people in the state house of representatives. So they keep that same tradition going with their restaurants.
Yeah, that's like the stupid lib joke where they're like, "No, a guy with a big truck has a small cock." But it was, so we went there. It was a Carly event, and So the first guy who... Carly, by the way, had a lot of tendies, a lot of mozzarella sticks. Really good stuff.
Mozzarella sticks is pretty sweet.
Yeah, mozzarella sticks are the fucking best. But we get
I don't picture that, though. That's fucking... That's one of the things that's kind of disgusting, right? Is that, like, Carly Fiorina probably didn't have mozzarella sticks and chicken tendies.
Oh, she's never eaten those in her life.
No, she's never eaten that. She'd vomit.
Get that away from me. Get that away. I don't want to smell it.
Did you guys see that story of that claim that Heidi Cruz, Ted Cruz's wife, was so disgusted by the dirty citizens of Iowa that she had to take a shower after every public appearance?
I saw that story too. Look it up; it's amazing. There's all these like screen caps of her shaking hands with people.
She's shaking hands with these.
You can see the look on her face.
These corn-fed monsters, and she's just internally repelled. You can tell her shoulders are kind of scrunched up, and you can see that she's just viscerally grossed out by them.
Fucking wonderful.
By the way, we were talking about Grover Norquist being the Tribune of Vapors. 17 minutes ago, he tweeted, "The lifestyle brown shirts who hate vaping and tweet their anger at the idea of 10 million vapers voting in self-defense make my point."
Yeah, he is
who hates vaping?
You proved my point, guys.
You proved her point. He also, in that tweet, he capitalized vaping. I don't know if that was autocorrect.
That was a choice.
Who hates vaping, though?
I mean, people make fun of vaping because it's kind of silly, but... To turn it into, the thing is, it's like anything in this atomized, commodified hellscape we live in where there's no identity pegs to, to feel any kind of sense of identity towards other than what you're buying. It turns into a fetish, and yeah, that's silly, but, beyond that, it's not any dumber than anything else. It's not any dumber than being a Whovian or whatever the fuck.
No, absolutely not.
I will vote for any candidate who says, I want to be your president in Gallifreyan.
I just want somebody who will admit when they're running for president that news radio was the best sitcom of the 90s.
Oh, yes.
Fucking best, and it brought us Joe.
It did bring us the god, Joe Rogan.
God King.
Fucking Rogan 2016. Fuck this shit.
That's right.
I'd go for that, though.
DMT. Put some DMT in the water supply.
I mean, listen to this, guys. The next election, after Trump's success, people are just going to fucking be like, I'm going to give it a shot. Every crazy motherfucker with $1 billion is going to be like, I'm going to try it. I'm just going to see if I can do it. And if I can't,
they're going to try it, but they're going to realize very quickly that they don't have the same kind of game that Trump does.
No, he is something, man. He runs his own campaign, right?
Basically. He has almost no staff, and I'm 100% convinced that that's the reason that he's so hated by guys like Luntz. It has anything to do with ideology. It has to do with the fact that the RNC is this massive grift, like we were talking about, these fucking failtards who shit the bed all the time but keep getting rehired to be consultants or pollsters or ad buyers. And Trump basically he's hired nobody. There was a hilarious story that I heard about him going to Iowa, and he'd heard that some other campaign had been doing internal polls, and he said, why are they doing that? Why are they paying for that? The networks do polls for free. The very idea of doing basic campaign infrastructure was like, that's a waste of money. So he doesn't have these guys.
He's kind
of right, though. Yeah, well, he's absolutely right. But so these guys, they exist to be like barnacles on the side of these campaigns. And the day that you have a guy who has the kind of just frankly magnetism and ability to pop on TV to not need that, to be able to do a national campaign just by being on TV and getting the kind of free publicity that Trump does, they're all out of a job. And so all of them are shitting themselves at the prospect of that future.
I'm not afraid to admit that after this most recent debate where Trump said on stage at a Republican debate that George W. Bush lied us into Iraq and it was a disaster, and like he's still winning. I mean, like I'm rooting for Trump to get the Republican nomination much as I'm rooting for Bernie Sanders to get the Democratic one at that
absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely.
I like how fucking stupid the political writers are, because literally the RNC's trick of like having the only Marco fans in the world show up to the debate.
Yeah, yeah.
And that they're like, well, Trump lost.
Yeah. These idiots booed him the whole time, so clearly everyone hates him. It's like, I was finding myself agreeing with when Trump was going, these guys, these special interests in the audience, and the way that they were just like, it was like a push button. It was like Rubio or Bush talked, and they would applaud, and anybody else said anything, they would boo. It's like, these guys do sound like they were brought in. This does sound like a rigged audience.
Yeah. That's all they have to hear, too. That's all the fucking people that are for him have to hear is like, they fucking rigged the audience against the guy. They definitely don't want him. That means we want him. The harder they push, the more they're just going to gravitate to Trump. I don't think there's any way he can lose now. I mean,
If he wins South Carolina, yeah, I think it's pretty much over.
I feel like my favorite thing, just going back to the booze for a second, is the RNC or Right to Rise or whoever is so fucking stupid that this is how they try to sabotage like the one guy on stage who isn't upset by booing. Like, he's an entertainer. He knows how to work through it. It's not like Jeb, who just like curls his stupid fucking rich kid lips and is like, well, you don't know how bad you look right now.
Seriously, if the crowd booed Rubio the way they boo Trump, he would kill himself on stage, Bud Dwyer style.
Take his tie and tie it on the podium and himself.
Trump would swallow the microphone and choke to death.
Trump has actually done professional wrestling. Like, he's been involved with that. He knows what it takes to get people to pay attention.
That the only thing that matters is heat. It doesn't have to be good or bad. It's just you need to be over. And over doesn't have any kind of normative value place to it. Is the crowd responding? That's the only question.
This thing has amazed me at how bad politicians are responding to booing. Like, Bernie's actually okay at it. I was amazed, like, during the first Democratic debate, how, like, Lincoln Chafee, when people... I felt bad for Lincoln Chafee the entire time when people booed him, and he was like, oh, come on.
Come on, everybody. Come on, man. Please just don't say that.
But Rubio storm out, like, crying if people fucking booed him. Like, and Jeb, like, we've seen what happened when people boo Jeb. He just shuts down. And Kasich, I don't know what Kasich did. Someone showed me a video that Kasich just wanders around or talking to him. So he'd probably just leave.
It does suck to bomb, though. I mean, when you're getting booed as a politician, you're doing the exact opposite thing. Like, these guys would much prefer indifference. You know, a guy like Kasich would... pay for indifference. Like, he would pay.
He is paying for indifference. That's what he's getting.
Because he's going with this fantasy of, he's basically trying to resurrect that Obama idea of, you know what, if we just bring everybody together, everything will be okay. And so, yeah, he doesn't want the crowd to respond. He just wants everybody to sort of like solemnly nod along. It's like, yeah, it's true. We all need to be brought back together by someone who, you know, has ridden the rails for a few years and knows how it goes.
Yeah, he's been running his campaign based on, like, which chalk drawings on, like, mailboxes and water towers he discerns mean good victuals or bad dogs.
I've seen your state. I know which houses a good Christian woman lives in, a man with a secret. John Kasich is the drifter for Mad Men, who's Don Draper's dad, Stiff.
Yep. Played by Father Rintintola.
Paul Schultz, yeah.
Great actor.
Absolutely.
God, he is... When he promised to get Pink Floyd back together, I was like, this fucking guy is like... He's clean as a whistle. Like, that's the other thing too, is he's going for the values voters that have already decided, like, on Trump or Ted Cruz, by the way.
Yeah, but he's not nearly religious enough. He's not nearly openly religious enough.
What he wants is the religious people who get upset when they see fighting. Because right now Trump's whole thing, and Cruz's to a lesser extent, is like the people who are like, who want Armageddon to happen, or at the very least, like Kurt Schlichter types, who when Scalia died are like, ooh, this is the opening salvo of Second Civil War. Let me load a few more magazines. But like, that is a big chunk of the Republican electorate. But then there are sort of mild suburban dads who just want to watch History Channel and have a president that they can believe in because they're white. And that's who Kasich is pitching towards. You know, and I think it's a nice chunk, but it's definitely not enough.
It's so not enough.
Because they're pissed, man.
A strong vice presidential. Like, I think if Trump him as a vice president, that'd be a tough ticket for anyone to beat.
And that very well could happen, because they basically have not fought at all.
They haven't fought at all, and I also hear that the sort of donor class of the Republican Party also loathes John Kasich simply because he accepted a Medicare expansion in Ohio.
But John Kasich did run those ads against Trump, like with that, you know, first they came for me.
That's true. I forgot about that, yeah.
That'd be a deal breaker. And Kasich has also said that he'd be a terrible vice president.
That was so funny. I can't have people telling me what to do. That's why I got fired for 15 straight jobs as a short order cook, because I wouldn't tell those motherfuckers having me tell me what to do.
Listen, look, I'm not the type of guy who tells anyone what to do, and I don't like to be told what to do myself. You know what I mean? People tell me what to do, and the next thing they're trying to take something from you.
God damn. I want to hang out with him. He is much more interesting. Like, his part of his grift is that he seems boring. You know what I mean? Like, but then when you start...
Oh, he's a freak. This guy called up Blockbuster Video and screamed at them for having Fargo on the shelves. He's a freak.
But strangely, he seems more like a human being and not a reptile than any of the other Republicans.
Because his rage, while insane, comes from a human place. Like, he watches a movie with violence, and he is repulsed by it, and has this native desire to... no one else should see this. That's something that, as a human, you might not agree with it, but you can understand it.
Whereas,
but like Cruz and Rubio, they're dreaming alien dreams.
Like, Cruz's insanity is that he watches... The classic canon of The Simpsons and loves it and thinks it confirms what he already believes in. That's his special
I'm still convinced that Ted Cruz loves The Simpsons but doesn't think that it got good until like season 13.
Yeah. Ted Cruz's favorite episode of The Simpsons is like when Tony Hawk comes on and shit. He's like, that's just wonderful. Who would have ever thought that Tony Hawk would show up? And
I mean, he's a professional skateboardist. It's ridiculous.
Oh, man. Well, thank you guys all for doing this show and for taking one for me by watching the movie.
Our pleasure.
Now I
it was my pleasure. I smuggled in a flask and I had a great time.
Yeah.
So, everyone go see 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi.
Yeah, please.
They don't want you here.
And does that, yeah. So what you
and,
can find
and follow John Nolte and Sonny Bunch and read their takes on movies.
Yeah, read the John Nolte movie tweets that aren't jacking off to cleavage, which is a good 50% of them. He is one thirsty motherfucker.
Sorry, I just need to say one thing more about my friend Nolte. Follow him because he'll go into rages about the murderers who need to go to hell, and then he'll just have something that says, "The wife won't let me watch the new season of Falling Skies tonight. Oh, well." I just think there's little glimpses into this utter banality.
That's like that fucking football team, the Chargers, the one that says, like, "I'm waiting for my wife to get home so I can go get..." Have you seen that tweet from like 2009 when some idiot owned the Chargers Twitter instead of the Chargers, and they just never delete it. And it's like it's a guy just saying like I hope my wife takes me to Chick-fil-A. Or see, somebody's gonna bring it up, and now I just fucked that up. But thank you guys all for doing the show. You can find any of these guys at Cushbomb, CUSHBOMB on Twitter. That's Matt. Will Menaker, WILLMENAKER, and By Your Logic. He used to be Swarthy Villain, but they took that away from him.
Fucking bastards.
Yeah, that's the meanest shit, man.
Those goddamn
martyrs.
We are, yeah, he is one of the February 17th martyrs.
Yeah.
He is. Well, so thanks for, sorry.
I'd say the missing 12,000 followers that I am owed are the real martyrs.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. So go there, and you got links to all your cafe articles and Carl Digler stuff. There,
I do.
Right?
I do, and there is a Marshall Harford coming out tomorrow.
Oh, yes.
Don't think we forgot about him.
Oh, God, I'm glad. It's been a while.
I love him. I have a special – he is me – like when I first said, like, hey, buddy, I'm an anarchist. And then it was like, fuck, I'm going to take on the whole fucking thing now. I see little parts of me in there, like, that I've been able to pull back on as I've softened up a little bit. So thanks for listening, guys. And we'll see. You're going to get 3 shows this week.
Well, if it is, as I say, if it's a cover-up, if it's an intentional deception, how foolish can you be to think that this is not going to come out at some point?
Commander in chief, who stole truth, love.